Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 22, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call. Your telephone has been muted until the question and answer portion of the call. Today, we'll be discussing Horn versus U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Supreme Court decision from earlier today. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back our expert, John Elwood. He's a partner at the law firm of Vinson & Elkins right here in Washington, D.C. He's been with us before a couple times, and in particular, he's been with us on this same case, Horn versus U.S. Department of Agriculture. With that, Mr. Elwood, please walk us through the case and let us know what happened.
Great. Well, I'm happy to be here. To begin with, I even though people who know me know that I try to be something of a cut-up, but I will try to avoid any grape or raisin-related jokes because I hate puns, and I will make my plea now for the Federal Society to drop any callers who make jokes about wrinkles in the case or sour grapes or anything like that. And with that, I will proceed. If you're on the call, you already know this case involves the Federal Raisin Marketing Order that was implemented by the Department of Agriculture under the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act of 1937. Congress enacted the AMAA during the Great Depression in an effort to, quote-unquote, insulate farmers from competitive market forces that it believed caused unreasonable fluctuations in supplies and prices. That, as the government recounts in its brief in this case, that in response to rises in prices, people would respond as the market would be expected and even encouraged to do by planting extra acreage, and then prices would drop, and that they thought that this was a bad thing and they needed stability by more or less controlling the output. The Raisin Marketing Order was put in place in 1949. The government argues that that is necessary because although demand is stable at about 211,000 tons of raisins per year being consumed domestically, supply can be highly variable, being as low as 240,000 tons and 98-99 to 430,000 tons in 2000 to 2001. And the Secretary of Agriculture estimates that farmers received something like $142 per ton higher during 2002-2003 than if it were unregulated. So they claim that this is unbalanced benefits farmers. And, you know, in fairness to them, it is most farmers haven't complained about this. Most raisin producers haven't complained about this. It's a relative minority that have. Raisin Marketing Order limits the quantity of raisins that can be sold by raisin handlers, the people who collect together and package and sell, I guess on the wholesale market, raisins. It limits the quantity of raisins that handlers can sell in the domestic market. The Raisin Administrative Committee decides how much of the crop is going to be free tonnage, that is how much farmers are free to, or how much handlers are free to sell, and how much is a reserve tonnage. Handlers pay the producers only for the free tonnage, the stuff that they are allowed to sell. The handlers segregate the reserve tonnage, which is actually put in the government, entitled to the government, even though the handlers hold on to it. The Raisin Administrative Committee then may sell the raisin, the reserve tonnage raisins to handlers for resale on the overseas market. You know, they sell them abroad, or they can direct that they be sold or given to secondary non-competitive markets, such as school lunch programs and things like that. The sales are used first to finance the Raisin Administrative Committee's administrative costs, that is, the people who decide what is done with the raisins. And if anything is left over, the producers receive a portion of that on a pro rata basis. By regulation, the Raisin Administrative Committee is supposed to maximize value, and sometimes they, you know, do a reasonable job of that. In other years, not so much. In the years at issue here, which are 2002 to 2003 and 2003 to 4, the committee, Raisin Administrative Committee, took 47% of the crop, nearly half, and they paid far below the cost of production back to the raisins. And in 2003-04, they took 30% of the crop, and they paid the farmers nothing for that. But also, you know, for the past 5 years, there were no reserves at all. That is, all of it was free tonnage. And there were years where there were only 10 to 15% reserves. So this, you know, the raisin producers who challenged this, the raisin handlers, I guess they are raisin handlers for purposes of this case, they picked two very good years to use as their test case. They are well represented. The raisin handlers here attempted to avoid the order, which applies only to handlers, thinking that if they sold directly to wholesalers, they wouldn't be treated as handlers. But the Department of Agriculture thought differently, and the Raisin Administrative Committee sent a truck and actually tried to seize the reserve amount. And when they were refused admission by the Horns, they instead sent a demand letter for $400,000-some, which was the fair market value of the raisins that were supposed to be the set-aside, the reserve crop. They sought judicial review of the enforcement action that the Department of Agriculture took against them. During the first go-round, the Ninth Circuit said that it lacked jurisdiction over the defense that it was an uncompensated taking. They said that that had to be brought basically after you pay the fine. You then have to take the case to the Court of Federal Claims under the Tucker Act and sue there. So this case has been to the Supreme Court before. On the first go-round, I think that the Supreme Court reversed the Ninth Circuit unanimously, saying that they were entitled to challenge the constitutionality in the district court action that was challenging the compliance order. And it went back on remand to the same panel of the Supreme Court, or I'm sorry, the same panel of the Ninth Circuit, which is Reinhart, Hawkins, and Gould. I think Hawkins wrote both times, although I honestly forget who wrote it this time. He wrote it in the last go-round. But the Ninth Circuit held essentially that it was not a takings, that per se takings only applies to real property and doesn't involve controversies involving personal property, such as raisins. And it said that because the Horns retained benefits flowing from the use of the raisins by the Raisin Administrative Committee, remember, they get the supposed benefit of price stabilization, and they also get the benefit of the reserve of the value of whatever is left over after paying the Raisin Administrative Committee's expenses. And they said that between those two, they didn't lose all economically valuable use of their personal property unless there was no takings. The Horns brought the case back up to the Supreme Court, and they took it again. People who were on the last call, I said that the argument went extremely well for the challengers, for the Horns, and I said it was easily 5-4 and that Kagan and Breyer were also available votes, and possibly Sotomayor. My notes don't indicate what I thought of Justice Ginsburg's vote, and my memory is so bad that I can't remember what I thought of Justice Ginsburg's vote. But today's decision was a complete vindication for the Horns. There were three questions presented, and they won on all three of them. And they not only won on all three of them, but they won basically with the court saying what the challengers said should be said on each of the three issues. And they really won by an 8-1 margin on each of these major questions, that although there was a partial dissent by Justices Breyer joined by Ginsburg and Kagan, all eight votes pretty much agreed with everything here. And I'll say when there's an asterisk on that, only Justice Sotomayor dissented across the board. The first question was whether the categorical duty to pay just compensation when the government physically takes possession of an interest in property applies only to real property and not to personal property. And the court today said, like you would have expected, of course it applies to personal property. It's a good day for Magna Carta. You know, shortly after the 800th anniversary of it, the document again got a shout out, and it got a shout out for protecting personal property explicitly there, because after all, a lot of these were a lot of sort of anti-takings provisions were done in order to prevent the government from taking personal property for troops in the field, such as, you know, taking food, and that is what Magna Carta spoke to directly was corn. It distinguished regulatory takings cases on the ground that here there was a physical appropriation, and although this is a strong opinion for physical appropriation, that is also its major limitation, is that today's opinion was very clearly and emphatically and repeatedly limited to physical appropriation where title passed and the raisins to the government. and that was shored up. But if the government is interested in doing this type of program in the future, my theory is that they will just impose a use restriction, as we will see later, just as Sotomayor suggests in dissent. The court emphasized that the distinction between regulatory takings and the sort of pro per se standard flows from the subtle difference between types of appropriation and regulation. A physical taking and a regulatory limitation on production may have the same economic impact on a grower, but as the court said, the Constitution, however, is concerned with means as well as ends. That's on Slip Opinion page 9. The second question was whether the government can avoid the categorical duty to pay just compensation by reserving a contingent interest in a portion of the value of the property set at the government's discretion. That is how the challengers framed it, obviously in a way that's very favorable to the challengers. But the idea is that when you get paid the kind of the residual after everything else is taken care of, is that still a categorical duty to pay just compensation? Is there still one for that? And the court held today unequivocally that the fact that the growers retain a contingent interest of indeterminate value does not mean that there has been no physical taking, particularly since the value of the interest depends on the discretion of the taker, and it may be worthless, as it was for the one of the 2 years at issue here. The way that the Chief Justice put it during the hand down, he said orally, is, you know, when the government takes your car, it doesn't, you know, become not a takings just because essentially they return the quarters that they find stuck down in the seats. And I have to say that when the chief has such great lines like that, he kind of takes some of the wind out of the sails of people like me who are trying to derive humor from it on their own. You're left with nothing better than just repeat the justice's own comments. But I think that was maybe – this was really the most work that was done here, because I think that the answer was pretty clear to most fair-minded people that – the takings clause applies to personal property, and based on the history in this country, it was pretty clear that that applies to personal property. So this is, I think, the biggest holding here. The third question is whether a governmental mandate to relinquish specific identifiable property as a condition on permission to engage in commerce, this is confusing, so I'll try to explain it, affects a per se taking. And so basically, when they order you to turn over property as a condition of, you know, engaging in the market, is that a per se taking? And here, you know, the government's argument here was, you know, look, these people could have avoided this by selling their grapes as table grapes or using it to make fruit juice or wine. You know, they chose to participate in this particular market, and because of that, it's not a taking if we say in order to sell raisins in this country, you know, it's a regulated market. In order to sell raisins in this country, you got to give us a percentage. And they said that that was therefore not a taking. And the court, again, 8-1 said, you know, bunk. Here they said, the chief used some pretty good lines here, too. He said, let them sell wine is probably not much more comforting to the raisin growers than similar retorts have been to others throughout history. And, you know, more, you know, that's a good applause line. But the work was done by noting essentially that the court in Loretto, remember that's the case involving the takings to put cable boxes outside of buildings in Manhattan, that Loretto had rejected, you know, basically virtually identical arguments that, you know, that only applied to people who ran apartment houses and they could do other things with their property if they wanted to avoid that. And they said it doesn't work like that. The Supreme Court said that in Loretto, and more or less the court now just repeated that same argument. So they more or less repeated the line in Loretto. So again, I think the second question presented is the biggest argument, although, you know, it's useful to repeat that because it had been a number of years, and there were really facts that the Chamber of Commerce raised in its excellent amicus brief, I wrote it, that talked about those kind of, you know, circumstances where similar things happened. The court also in this section of the opinion distinguished various cases that the government had cited, including Ruckelshaus versus Monsanto, which required makers of pesticides to give up essentially intellectual property by turning over, you know, their intellectual property information in order to sell pesticides. And the chief's response to that was, raisins are not dangerous pesticides, they are a healthy snack. So you now have something you can cite if you ever need to, you know, show that raisins are a healthy snack. Maybe you can cite it with your kids. They also distinguished an oysters case from around the turn of the century, as I recall, involving, it's the Leonard and Leonard case requiring oyster producers to remit 10% of the oyster shells to the state of Maryland as a privilege tax, which was found not to be a takings there. And the court's reasoning was that raisins are not like oysters. Oysters are wild animals that belong to the state, whereas raisins are private property. And making a pun here, or a play on words at least, the court said that these are the fruits of the grower's labors, not public things subject to the absolute control of the state. So far, the opinion was 8-1. We're now entering the 5-4 part, where it was essentially the court's conservatives. They rejected the argument that the calculation of the just compensation must consider the value the reserve raisins would have been would have had without the price support program. The government argued basically, you know, look, if this is a takings, you got to consider how much our reserve program enhanced the value of the raisins. And the court said no by a 5-4 vote. They said just compensation normally is measured by the market value of the property at the time of the taking. And they said, sure, in the future, there may be complex questions of how you have offsetting benefits or how you value offsetting benefits against condemnation of land or appropriation of property. But here, he said, and this is kind of where the chief's opinion gets clever, he said the government has already calculated the amount of just compensation when it fined the Horns the fair market value of the raisins for not turning over the reserve amount like they demanded, like the government demanded. And that was already, we already know that amount. It's $483,000 and change, more or less. And the government can't disavow that evaluation. And so the court said, in a rare case, it just reversed without need for a remand. So this is the rare case of eventually reversing and rendering judgment for the for one party, which I've seen done many times, particularly in the Fifth Circuit. But I can't recall the last time this happened at the Supreme Court. They are a very remand happy court. They like to decide the principles and leave its implementation for the lower court on remand. I suspect that it is not a coincidence that this is in the Ninth Circuit, which the Supreme Court has had kind of a rocky relationship with in the past. There were three separate opinions. The first was by Justice Thomas, very short, just to emphasize that the public purpose limitation of the takings clause, that takings have to be for public purpose, that is a real limitation, however you read Kelo. Remember the case from, I think, New London or whatever. He said that is a real limitation. And this was the first of the, what I count as a bad pun. Justice Thomas signed off by saying, quote, to the extent that the committee is not taking the raisins for public use, having the Court of Appeals calculate just compensation in this case would be a fruitless exercise, unquote. And I still like Justice Thomas, even though he wrote that. Justice Breyer concurred in part and dissented in part, joined by Ginsburg and Kagan. He joined, as I say, most of the court's opinion, the answering of all three questions presented. But he dissented on the compensation part. He said that the case law I have found indicates that the government may well be right that the marketing order may afford just compensation for the taking of raisins that imposes, so that even though there may be a taking here, that the compensation that you get through the marketing order is its own compensation. He noted that the reserve requirement is intended, at least in part, to enhance the price that free tonnage raisins will fetch on the open market, and if the benefit exceeds or equals the value of the raisins taken, the California raisin marketing order doesn't affect the taking without just compensation. So, you know, there may be a taking, but there's no need for just compensation here. Justice Sotomayor dissented alone. She saw the case more or less, I think, the way the Ninth Circuit did, that because the order doesn't deprive the Horns of all their property rights, it doesn't affect a per se taking. The way she read Loretto, which, I don't understand how she reads it this way, but she said to qualify as a per se taking under Loretto, the government action must so completely destructive of the property owner's rights to basically leave nothing left under Penn Central than Penn Central framework for regulatory takings. She said that the retention of even one property right that isn't destroyed is sufficient to defeat a claim of per se taking under Loretto. And she emphasized, I think correctly, that raisins are a fungible commodity that is sold, and so income is the central interest. And the fact that, you know, most years you got something back that was enough to deprive, keep you from making a per se takings claim. And she said, you know, she emphasized that this emphasized that the program here facilitated classic regulatory goals of kind of limiting output to prop up prices and arranging for the orderly disposition of property. And she made one point that I think is well taken. She says, that this is ultimately instructs the government that it can permissibly achieve its market control goals by imposing a quota without offering raisin producers anything by way of a return, saying basically, you know, they can just only sell so much, and after that, they just got to sit and let those raisins rot. And that, you know, that is kind of not much help to the raisin producers and handlers because they will still only be able to sell so much, but they won't even get anything for it. And I think that is the biggest question for this case. It was a complete vindication, as I say, of the raisin handlers' positions. They got everything they asked for, at least within reason. I haven't reread the brief to see if there's anything in footnotes that they asked for, but there are three major points. They were, you know, they got exactly what they wanted. And that, to me, is the biggest question, is what will the government do with this? Because in my own experience, which tends more towards environmental cases, that the government will take anything that is left to it, any options that are left to it, in those cases and do what it can with them. I don't know if that will still be the case here, because as the government pointed out, that for the last several years they haven't had set aside amounts for raisins. And I don't know if that's because they've been on their best behavior because this lawsuit was pending at the time, or if it's because raisin growers are better about estimating demand and only growing enough to meet demand or what. But that is, to me, the big question mark. And the thing that raisin handlers have to be asking themselves in the future is, what is next for regulation in this particular area? Those are all the points that I had to make. I apologize for going quickly. It's a leftover of doing high school debate, and also because I want to leave as much time as possible for answering your questions. So with that, I will turn it over to the floor and any questions you may have.
Terrific. Thank you so much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question for John Elwood, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, we've got quite a few people on the phone, but plenty of time for questions. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our first caller of the day, let me make our typical announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call looks like it's going to be scheduled for tomorrow at 1 p.m. We'll be discussing another case handed down today by the court, Kimball versus Marvel Enterprises. That's a copyright case that I think concerns Spider-Man. Today, of course, we're speaking with John Elwood. Push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. But for right now, let's go to our first caller.
Thank you. My question is, how far will the policy implications of this decision reach? How many other federal agricultural programs are now suspect and subject to termination?
You know, that's a good question. This is something that we talked about during the last call. And my sense of them is that there are, from argument, is that there are a decent handful of them that are similar to this one. I think if my memory serves, it's like something like 8 to 10 is the one that is what I believe Ed Needler, the government's lawyer, said. So I think that this is potentially to all of them. I think in the future, the government is, I think, obviously going to want to not have to pay for this stuff. So I think that beginning today, any programs where the government takes title to agricultural commodities are, you know, immediately over, and that henceforth they're going to be done through regulation. I believe, though, that I think that the handwriting was on the wall. I think that the government lawyer was a savvy enough guy that I suspect that he saw which way this was going. So I'd be very interested to know, if anyone does know this, whether the government took steps immediately after argument to start retooling these programs so that they could do them in a way that avoids running afoul of the takings clause.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending at this point before we go to our next caller. John, what would a rejiggered or retooled program look like? Do you have something in mind there that the government could use to get to the same place but through a different route that the court wouldn't find objectionable?
Well, I think that what they would have to do is to treat it more as a regulation. That it was really a fairly narrow, I mean, this is a complete victory, but it was a fairly narrow victory in the sense that the thing that the majority just kept coming back to again and again was there was a physical appropriation of property here. And so what the government can do is a regulatory taking. They can just impose conditions on sales of things. And that could be as simple as a quota. And it wouldn't be that hard to redo this as a quota system. You would just have the Raisin Administrative Committee say, you know, that number that we've been saying is the free tonnage? Well, now that's a hard cap. You guys can't sell any more than that, and you have to hold on to it. I think that that would be enough that you couldn't do anything more about that. Another thing that the government could do is to, you know, just impose regulation on it in some sense, because regulatory takings on the whole are very difficult to litigate. And it's a much harder question. It's a much harder thing to take care of in the courts. And so as long as the government stays on the regulatory taking side of the line, their life becomes much easier and they can avoid, or at least it's a problem that they can take care of using the Justice Department to litigate these cases. They will at least not be out of pocket. And as long as they avoid physical appropriation of these commodities, I think that they can stay out of, they can avoid having to pay for anything other than Department of Justice litigators.
So you mentioned Kelo. There was a huge backlash to the Kelo decision, I guess, 10 years ago now. Is there any hint in this case, up and down the court system, that the courts were aware of the backlash and considered that, the public distaste for the outcome in the Kelo decision?
You know, I didn't really see that in any of the opinions. I think that they are aware of that, as they were sitting on the as they were on the bench for argument. They were noticeably harsher to the government's lawyers than they were to the Horn's lawyers. And Justice Kennedy was unusually, I thought, sarcastic and hard on the government's lawyer. And the Chief Justice made a comment, which actually wound up figuring in the opinions, about the government's people coming in the dead of night in order to take possession of the raisins. And I think the Chief meant that as a joke. But I thought it was interesting that Justice Sotomayor mentioned that in her opinion, and saying that, you know, I forget what exactly she said about them, but she was trying to draw the sting and saying they did not arrive in the dead of night. And the Chief made a point of noting that they showed up at 8 a.m. to take possession, which is, the other, at least it wasn't 6 a.m. as the government, you know, ordinarily executes warrants. But it was nevertheless not at a time that was the most convenient, I think, for the Horns to be dealing with them. So I do think that there is a certain amount of impatience with the government, that the government has, to a certain extent, worn out its goodwill in takings cases, and they are going to be viewing them with a certain amount of suspicion.
If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines are wide open.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Ewing. This was a great presentation. I really appreciate it. And my question is about the extent to which this could be applied in certain state actions. The one that I have in mind particularly, in one state, there's an automobile license law that if you don't renew your license within 30 days of the date it expires, your vehicle plates, then there's assessed a $100 fine. And the only way you can see if you come within one of the exceptions to that fine is to pay the fine and then appeal it, treat it as a claim for a refund to the state government. And I'm wondering if those kinds of things would come within the reach of this ruling.
You know, I think that's going to be a tougher case. Although obviously this is done on federal constitutional grounds, so it applies to the states, that there are two distinctions there. One is, I think, that To begin with, that's a licensing thing, and it's not anything that you would have a right to do. If it was something that you would have a better claim, but that strikes me as more along the lines of the Ruckelshaus versus Monsanto case, where you're trying to get permission to do something that a government could regulate. They're selling pesticides here, driving your automobile or whatever. And it is an automotive licensing law to use it on the streets. Is that right?
Well, it's in addition to paying for the
property tax.
The property tax, the specific ownership tax, you have to pay a penalty of. That's on top of it. Now, I would assume that they're taking your money when they make you pay that penalty before you find out whether or not the penalty applies to you as a medical exception or overseas servicemen or whatever it may be that they is their criteria for excusing you from the fine.
And I think that is kind of more along the lines of the first Horn case where they said you don't have to essentially contest it and pay the fine and then go to the Court of Federal Claims and file for the refund essentially there. But that was, I think, largely a statutory question. So it probably would depend on state law, although certainly, to the extent so many states' laws, if there is a federal analog, are patterned after the federal law because, it is a kind of a cheaper way of doing it. You don't have to worry about how things are phrased. You already have a body of law that you can draw on. And so to the extent that the state law is patterned after the federal jurisdictional statutes, you could maybe cite that in saying that you should be able to, litigate it in any enforcement action. Basically, if they come after you for not paying the $100, you could litigate it in the same action.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Very good.
Still one question pending. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Take another call.
This is Paul Larkin from the Heritage Foundation. I have a question about from where the court will go after today's decision. The reason I ask that is this. A while back ago in the Nolan case, the Supreme Court said the state can't grant a permit to make a development on your property and in the process grant itself access to your property. And then they had a later case, Dolan, where they elaborated on that. And then in the most recent case, they said the state can't deny you a permit if it does so because you're not willing to give up the property. Are we going to see a similar development here, that here the Supreme Court said the government can't take your property, even though they're trying to limit the amount of raisins overall? And so if they can't take your property for that purpose, they can't tell you to hold on to it and put in basically a limit along the lines of what I think someone mentioned earlier, just cap the amount of raisins that can be sold. Because in essence, what you're doing is telling people that they can't sell it and they have to hold on to it themselves rather than the government taking it to keep you from doing it.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Ordinarily, I think that you would be able to say that is certainly kind of the way that we are trending. I think the limiting factor is whether you can persuade Justice Kennedy of that. He's been a pretty pro property rights recently, but he I view as kind of more wobbly than I would view the Chief and Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. So that's the question for me, is whether he is on board for all of that. I don't remember which way he came out on Kelo. I don't remember if he I presume that he was in the majority there, but I honestly don't remember.
He was. He was in the majority. He wrote separately, and he basically said you can always challenge it on the ground that the public interest or public purpose is a sham, but otherwise he was willing to go along with it.
Yeah, right. And so that's the one thing, is that I could see him. You know, I think that as long as he doesn't feel like it's going to deprive more or less regulators of their ability to get stuff done, that they need to get it done, I think that he would maybe be on board for that, on board for, you know, voting for the property rights owners. And that is, I think, the challenge, is just, making clear that there are plenty of other alternatives open for regulators, which I think that there would be, So we will see. It's just a matter of time, it seems like.
Thank you.
Let me make another call for questions. We don't have any questions pending. If you have a question, push the star button than the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if somebody else rings in with a question, let me ask you about the absence of a remand here, which I've never seen that before either. Just say, if you would, talk a bit more about that. Does it represent sort of the court's, the majority's passion for this case? Is it a rebuke of the Ninth Circuit, which got upheld in two other cases today? Was it directed at the whole Ninth Circuit or just this panel? Or did they maybe even not trust the Ninth Circuit to get the damages right in this case? I mean, could you just talk a bit more about that, if you would?
It is hard to say. It is really remarkable. Part of it is, you know, I have a lot of respect for John Roberts. He's somebody who really keeps his eye on the ball. Like, I think that this is true of Chief Justice Rehnquist as well. You know, they don't miss a lot. They have a remarkable degree of consciousness of everything that is going on around a case. And I think that it wasn't lost on him that there was a pretty good basis for saying there was already a valuation in this case. And you can, you know, in any event, you can avoid it by just not making them pay that fine. So I think partly it was because it was possible. And partly it was because he is a very clever man and he thought of the opportunity. I do think, you know, candidly that part of the thing that figured in this is the fact that this litigation has just been going on so long. It's already been to the Ninth Circuit twice, and there's kind of an asterisk on that because in order to spare the audience, I didn't mention that the Ninth Circuit, previously decided this case. They decided this case twice the first time. They first came up with the holding that they essentially did most recently. And then I think on reconsideration, they said we don't have jurisdiction even. And then they eventually, after losing on that, they reinstated their first opinion more or less. I mean, they changed it around some. But it may just be that this is dragged on long enough, and the Chief Justice did say that this case has already been dragged on for 10 years, so let's just put it out of its misery. But I do think that there is it was not lost on them, the chances that something more screwy could have happened on a remand, and so they just got rid of it. They just, you know, stuck a stake through the heart of this thing. But it was really noteworthy, and it will be very interesting to see, in another zillion years, whenever the papers are released on this case, whether there was any commentary on that within the court.
We do have another question. Let's go to our next caller.
As a court observer, the fact that the Chief Justice wrote this opinion, does that bode anything regarding the Obamacare decision coming down in the next 9 days or so?
Let me see, because I'm trying to think about what I was just counting cards earlier today. And because for the callers, typically each justice gets at least one opinion per sitting. And sometimes more than that. And because of that, you can, as the cases all get filled in, you can figure out exactly who's going to be writing and the opinions that remain. And let me see. I've already forgotten what month this is.
June.
It's the April sitting. So what we have left from that is, well, we know he's not writing same-sex marriage. The chief is not writing the same-sex marriage opinion. He's not writing the, or he's, I know he's not writing the, I used to speak English. He's not writing the Johnson versus United States. It's the crime. It's the residual. Do you remember that case?
No, I don't.
Johnson versus United States. It's killing me. But it's the Armed Career Criminal Act. Is that right? It's the residual clause of the Armed Career Criminal Act. And Glossop versus Gloss, which is the lethal injection case. So that's the main thing, is that we know he's not doing lethal injection, same-sex marriage, or the Armed Career Criminal Act case. But I always assumed that Scalia would be doing the Armed Career Criminal Act case if he were in the majority. And I think most people expect that Justice Kennedy is going to want to complete his punch card and do the same-sex marriage opinion if he can. Mm-hmm. The main thing is that it may be a sign that lethal injection may be found unconstitutional. We'll see. It's one more vote for finding lethal injection to be lawful.
And so does the fact that you wrote this opinion have any, does it augur anything for how the Obamacare decision is going to be come down?
No, but
since you may not be in the majority?
Yeah, no, but separately, I have been watching the Obamacare case pretty closely, and there's only three people from that sitting who don't have opinions yet. The chief, Kennedy, who I think are the two most likely, although the chief is the most likely to write the opinion there, and Kennedy is second most likely, and Ginsburg. Although at the moment, it looks to me like Ginsburg is on track not to have any opinion for that sitting. And that just is darn peculiar for me, and I can't figure out why not, because she's one of the most productive and hardworking members of the court, and it's very unusual for not to at least get one opinion, when for that month, Scalia, Breyer, and Alito each had two opinions each. So very peculiar thing there, very
right,
peculiar.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
We do have another question. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
This case reminds me a little bit of civil asset forfeiture. I can see distinctions, but is there any possibility that anything coming out of this case could strike a blow against the presumption of guilt in civil asset forfeiture?
Well, in the sense that it's interesting that you know, when civil asset forfeiture first came along, there was, because it was ordinarily, it's in criminal cases, and there was a heavy thumb on the scale for the government in those cases. But as it's, gotten broader and broader application, they've shown more and more impatience for it. And the Bajikagian cases, I'm sure you know, where they started applying, the Eighth Amendment to asset forfeiture. And I think that there is more impatience and more skepticism of the government in matters involving, particularly in matters involving private property. So, I don't know if there's any direct application, but I think that this case is emblematic of the court's, generally more pro-private property tilt in recent years.
The other thing this reminds me a little bit of is Wickard versus Filburn and the application of that to the recent, I think it was medical marijuana cases, where the marijuana was being grown by the user or within a state, never entering interstate commerce, and Wickard versus Filburn was, I think, wrongly relied upon, I think it should have been overturned, to support the government regulation of a interstate thing. But it's not really a taking case, but I wonder if this change in attitude could be applied to that. They might reverse themselves at some point.
It would be interesting. This opinion today does kind of put more pressure on that, because if the government does do what Justice Sotomayor predicts and basically just says you can only sell so much of it. Although I guess Wickard, it applied to use on the own farm, and at least in theory, people would be able to just, raisin producers and handlers would be able to sit and eat box after box of raisins themselves, or feed them to their chickens, as the case may be. Although, who knows, maybe they would try to restrict the use of raisins as chicken feed domestically, in which case it would be Wickard versus Philbin all over again. Although I tell you, if the marijuana case was, I think, the closest we've come to overruling Wickard versus Filburn, and I was surprised there how close that was when you're talking about regulation of marijuana, which, obviously is a controlled substance and all that. But, it was interesting to me how much sentiment there was that the government ought to lose that case. It'll be interesting to see what happens. And like with everything else, it depends a lot on the composition of the court. So You know, we have increasing percentage of the conservative votes on the court are, you know, well over the age of 70. So it'll be interesting to see where things go over the next 10 years.
I forget whether the sentiment was within the court for overturning that or not.
Well, there was at least hostility at argument. I don't remember what the vote was in the medical marijuana case, but there was at least hostility to hostile questioning against the government there.
Thank you.
We've got one question pending. Push the star button and the pound button if you'd like to ask a question. Another thing the court did today, John, is add a decision day. This Thursday, the court will be handing down at least one decision. So it's quite likely, or at least possible, we'll have another teleform this Thursday or Friday. So keep that in mind.
And in fact, they've added a new hand-down day on Friday. There will be hand-downs on Thursday and Friday, which makes it seem, you know, I can't remember when they went, the last time they went this late into June, in that if they have a hand-down day on Monday, the 29th is the latest in June that I can remember there being a hand-down day. So it may be that they're desperate to try to wrap things up, or they want to make sure that the 29th is a hard stop. So
right.
We'll see. Maybe if the Supreme Court is like every other institution of government, they will put out the bad news on Friday.
All right. Let's take another question.
Hey, John. This is Paul Larkin again from Heritage. I was just wondering, when you were talking about why they brought it into this, what the Supreme Court said to enter judgment here was similar to what the court said in the Bakke case back in 78, where they could have sent the case back to the California Supreme Court to decide whether there was some other reason why Bakke was not entitled to get into med school, but they just decided that enough was enough. And it seemed like that was what happened here. They just decided these people have been litigating this for so long, they ought just finally to win.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And it's also interesting just because if my recollection serves, that the California Supreme Court at the time was also thought to be kind of a outlier court, and it may be that they weren't particularly eager to send it there. Although Bakke actually, was it Regents versus Bakke or vice versa?
Regents versus Bakke.
Yeah, so I guess Bakke won on the California Supreme Court. That's interesting.
Yeah, I just thought they didn't want to give the California courts a chance to deny him admission on the ground that maybe he was too old.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because one of his problems applying was he was in his 30s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's interesting. But it's you know, I'm glad that you have cited that to me, because now I know that there's at least a precedent for it.
Any final question? If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's pause here for a second. We do have another question, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Paul Avalar. I'm an attorney with the Institute for Justice. I'm wondering if you could do some tea leaf reading here and share your thoughts on what this means potentially for future regulatory takings or other sorts of challenges to property rights restrictions or economic rights restrictions, if, as you say, what the court is seeming to be is a little more skeptical of the government's intentions, goals, or what have you in these sorts of cases going forward.
Sure. Well, one thing is, it seems like there's not much appetite for revisiting Kelo, because only Justice Thomas joined his separate opinion there. I think, you know, one thing, the Chief Justice, you know, typically is kind of a minimalist. We saw a lot of that in the Alonis case, which we also had a forum on, you know, only answering the question presented. And he really went out of his way, it seems like, to avoid questions about, you know, what do you do in takings or you know, eminent domain, where the property owner gets some benefit out of it, you know, that suggests to me that you know, it could be a combination of things. It could just be his sort of natural lowercase c conservatism, where he doesn't want to address a question where they don't have to. But it also may be that he just feels like the court isn't really ready to go there yet. And it may be a combination of the two. But I don't know if that is helpful at all, but I think that that is one area that we're this is going to go to next, because it seems like, you know, if the government is getting some sort of encouragement from the three partial dissenters, Breyer, Ginsburg, and Kagan, that they may see that there's at least some promise there, and there may be some ability to, you know, operate there where the people whose stuff is being taken nominally get some sort of benefit out of it. And if they do that via regulation, that's a much more difficult proposition to litigate that, and those claims are much less likely to succeed, the sort of regulatory takings cases. That's one of the points that several of the amici made, was that the difficulty of litigating those types of claims and the lack of clarity that makes it difficult for property owners to recover.
Let me pause again to see if there's a final question. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Very good. Well, John Elwood, it looks like we've exhausted the questions from the audience. We've got a couple minutes left. Let me revert to you and see if you have any final thoughts.
No, I don't. I can't say I have any other great thoughts on this. It will be interesting to see, though, as I say, what this means for regulation. And the thing that I will be the most interested to be looking for is whether the fact that the Raisin Administrative Committee hadn't been taking raisins for the last several years, whether they were doing that because, as I say, farmers have done a better job of anticipating what demand will be for raisins and adjusting their production to match, or whether it's just because they were lying low while this case was in litigation. Because if this is something that the government continues to need to do, or that the Raisin Administrative Committee feels that they need to do, and the Department of Agriculture feels it needs to be done, that particularly under Democratic administrations, they are going to come up with different ways of doing it. And I don't know if this is something that they need to retool the act that they're doing this under, or whether it's a purely regulatory thing that the executive branch is free to do. But we'll be finding that out in the coming years. Maybe this is something that will be the subject of an executive branch watch program, because this is an important thing for a lot of people in agriculture. And the only question here is whether this is an end of this type of program, or just it's going to be reappearing in a different guise.
Well, John Elwood, thank you so much for being with us today and for following this case up and down the court system. We certainly appreciate it. Today, raisins. Tomorrow, Marvel comic books, as we look at the Kimball versus Marvel characters case tomorrow at our teleforum tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And as John Elwood mentioned, later in the week, there are two more decision days just added by the court, Thursday and Friday, so we will very likely have teleforum conference calls later in the week as well, so do check the emails and the Federalist Society's website. But until that next call, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.